From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Here's a tip from the peak oil movement.
Once the oil is gone, the economy is going to be useless. And the traditional standby in this kind of thing is gold. And I talked to a lot of people who were buying gold.
More about peak oil in a moment. If, like a lot of people, you find it strangely compelling to think about the end of the world as we know it, there's no shortage of material these days. The looming oil crisis, war in the Middle East, the pollinator die-off, and the ever-popular Christian rapture projections. Today, visions of the apocalypse. Jim Crace uses fiction to prepare for the future in his new novel.
It's about our Western unconcern for the planet. It's about the dangers of being on the top of the pile. It's about the American dream and whether the American dream has become blemished in the same way as the American landscape has become blemished.
Also, the ultimate end time, the death of planet Earth.
We have argued that if the universe is accelerating, that in fact life ultimately has to end.
It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. And I feel fine.
That, of course, is REM's End of the World. But it's just the beginning. Journalist Bryant Urstadt wrote a story about the subject for Harper's Magazine called Imagine There's No Oil, Scenes from a Liberal Apocalypse. Urstadt attended the second conference on peak oil. He told Steve Paulson that the future as seen by the peak oil people involves something worse than inconvenience.
If you don't have oil, you can't drive your car. You can't fix your roads. The way the world is set up now, food typically comes from a very long way away. It is produced in a way that is very energy intensive with, you know, giant sort of corporate farms, which use quite a bit of fertilizer, which is also derived from fossil fuels, and then shipped great distances to get to the final gourmet at the other end. And when that collapses, your first issue is people are going to be hungry. This is the peak oiler's view of how it's going to play out. Starvation is a major thing, and from that is going to basically be all kinds of war and conflict and a fight over the remaining resources, not only oil, but food. Other things that are going to disappear are easy water supplies and, oh gosh, pretty much everything. Plastics, you know, shoes, for instance. One issue that came up again and again is the fact that the United States has essentially outsourced all of their shoe manufacturers, except for a very few people who actually make beautiful shoes but might not be useful in the coming post-apocalyptic world, has outsourced all these shoes to China and other countries. And if they're over there with no oil to get them back, where are we going to get our shoes from? So every sort of facet of life as we know it today will be affected in their view.
This has been called the liberals' apocalypse. Why is that?
Well, it does seem to fit in with kind of a few what might be considered liberal ways of looking at the world. And I haven't quite worked out exactly why that is. And in fact, I think that if you could call the religious apocalypse a more conservative version of the apocalypse, you might actually find that there's way more similarities than differences in kind of the general template of the apocalypse. So maybe that's not fair to call it purely a liberal thing when you look at it in that big picture. But in this sort of here and now picture, I think liberals have traditionally been very agitated about use of resources, pressure on the natural world. You know, the oil companies are certainly not a favorite of what might be considered the liberal mindset. And it also fits into a lot of things that liberals have been worrying about for a long time. Population growth is a huge one. And when you go and talk to these people, they are all basically liberals. That's the other reason.
Now, the idea of peak oil has been around for decades, right? I mean, this notion that we're going to start running out of oil at a certain point.
Well, yeah, and the idea that we're going to run out of energy, in fact, has been around for hundreds of years, really ever since the concept of entropy was invented. Lord Kelvin himself was really anxious about the world kind of winding down once he had established that, you know, energy is not this kind of constant thing that is lasts in a useful way forever, that it tends to dissipate. He was on about that in, you know, 1850 or whatever. And recently, and it sort of comes in cycles, we've worried about it too. The modern version of peak oil was formulated by M. King Hubbert, who was a geologist at Shell and just a brilliant guy who plotted a chart and really accurately predicted when the United States' production of oil would peak. In 1956, he called it to be around 1970, and he was pretty much dead on.
Hmm. So American production of oil has been declining since the 1970s.
Yes. He also went ahead and calculated out the value, as he saw it, for world production, and he predicted that it would happen around 2000. His work is a major basis for the peak oiler's view of the world. And that also suits many apocalypse templates in that there's an actual date when it's going to happen. That's a pretty common thing that I found when I started looking at these things.
Okay, well, we've already passed the year 2000. Was he right?
Well, no. We have not peaked. We seem like we might be close to peaking. We're not just running away up the side of a curve, but the production is increasing at last that I checked. But an important thing that I also found was that the fact that a predicted date had passed was really of no importance in the health of a movement. It just didn't factor in. People would rationalize it out and formulate a new date, and that's essentially what's happened. It's now been pushed back to 2010 by the people who study this sort of thing.
It's fascinating what you're suggesting. I mean, you're tying in this peak oil movement to apocalyptic movements in the past that tend to be more religiously based. I mean, you know, those notions that, you know, at a certain date, the world will end and, I don't know, we'll all ascend to heaven or something like that. But you're saying there are some similarities between those explicitly spiritual ideas and this peak oil movement.
I feel that to be true. You know, who knows if it is true, but it seems right to me. And part of what I did when I was paying attention to this was I read the book of Revelation, which is sort of an obvious thing to do. But the description and the parameters of destruction that are set out in Revelation are not so far away from the things that people are worrying about in peak oil, which makes me think there's just kind of a scheme for the end that just kind of suits the way we are as people for some reason. There's flooding in Revelation. There's pestilence. And peak oilers often talk about how, as the medical system breaks down, there is going to be huge suffering in terms of epidemics and stuff. There is war. Revelation is very specific about, you know, the great armies meeting on the fields of Megiddo, I think. That's Armageddon. And the peak oilers are serious about the idea that particularly China and the United States will probably get into some terrible war over the remaining oil in the Middle East. I could go on if I could remember more examples, which I might be able to. But
what about all the alternative energies that are out there that are in active production in some circles? I mean, there's wind, there's solar power, hydro. Some people even talk about nuclear, of course. I guess that's not exactly an alternative energy, but are these seen as viable alternatives to oil?
Well, if you're a serious peak oiler, no, none of the alternative energies will pick up the slack, and they have crunched just endless books full of numbers that seem to prove their case. At some point, it becomes a question of how you look at the world and what you think about the ways, you know, how clever you think people are. And I happen to think people are just too clever and will figure it out. The peak oilers take a little bit bleaker view, and they don't think, and they've run a lot of numbers which do make sense, that as it currently configured, that solar panels and wind and stuff can take up the slack. I think we're in a golden age right now, and there's some really cool things that are going to start happening, and I think they already have, but that's my personal point of view, so.
Now, given these disaster scenarios that the peak oilers themselves have come up with, how are they preparing for the future?
Well, they're getting ready to go back to the land in a way that's a lot more extreme than the back to the landers went when they went back to the land in the 70s, because they're getting ready to go back to the land without any help from modernity. So they are talking about things like root cellars. They're talking about very small, very energy efficient villages, which are kind of closely built with the fields kind of radiating along the outside so that all food production will be local.
And I'm assuming all these villages would be off the grid. I mean, they would be generating their own energy.
They talk a lot about, generating their own energy. They talk about wind power. Animal traction is a great term that I had never heard, which basically means plowing your field with an ox or other animal.
Wow.
Yes. I have a book here called The Long Emergency by James Howard Kunstler, and is quoted widely by peak oilers. And on the back is a picture of a horse pulling an old car with a guy sitting on the hood. Yeah, that's sort of their vision of the future. But they're very interested in learning how to do all the things that were probably commonplace or known by a lot of people in your sort of local neighborhood in the 19th century. They want to learn how to make shoes. They talk about how to can stuff. The people I talked to were in New York City, and they didn't have much familiarity with a lot of these skills, including familiarities with guns. And they actually went out on a sort of a field trip to learn how to use guns because they thought they might need to. And in their vision of the world, I guess they would.
Now, I've heard that one common piece of advice is that we should start buying gold.
Well, yes, of course, once the oil is gone, the economy is going to be useless because the industrial economy is kind of a big house of paper and trust. It's not like an old-fashioned economy where you had goods in your store and you sold them for money or other things. And the traditional standby in this kind of thing is gold. And I talked to a lot of people who were buying gold, and they suggested that I buy gold. And this was a year and a half ago, and they were right. I should have put all of my money into gold.
The value of gold has gone up, or the value of the dollar has
gone
up
by
down?
About, well, the gold has gone up about 50%, yeah.
Wow.
So I would have been, wouldn't have had to rely on this writing gig anymore. Could have retired to my armed to an armed village, but
maybe
yeah.
Maybe it's not too late. You can still go out and buy some gold.
Well, of course, you're right. I should. I keep meaning to, but yeah, of course, gold is the gold standard. So I know a lot of people, and I've actually seen one of their coins. You know, it's they're really doing it. Some of them are stockpiling food, you know, but getting ready. They feel that when it happens, it's really going to happen quickly. It's going to be a panic, not a kind of slow degradation.
Brian Erstad is a freelance writer from Connecticut. His piece, Imagine There's No Oil, was written for Harper's Magazine. Ken Eklund is the creator of the alternate reality game World Without Oil. The game allows players to join an online community and share alternate reality blogs, audio, and video clips based on Eklund's scenario, a world running out of oil. We decided to call Ken Eklund and ask him what happened in the dress rehearsal for A World Without Oil.
The game works very simply. It's an alternate reality event or an alternate reality game. So we're simulating an oil shock. And so when someone comes on the internet to worldwithoutoil.org, they kind of enter a rabbit hole, they plunge into an alternate reality where the oil shock is actually happening. And that's the website there is completely serious about it.
What happens when you get to the site? You see the page and it is as though this is the real world. But what do you do when you get there?
When you get there, you see like what the price of gas is, and there's a map, and then there are links to a bunch of stories. And so people kind of begin to click. There's a little button that says Mystified, start here, and then you kind of learn that there's a oil shock going on. If you just start clicking on the stories, these are stories which have been submitted to us essentially by players, just people out there on the internet, and those stories are all like the site. They're all completely serious, people imagining what their lives would be like if the oil shock were actually going on, kind of as we've sketched it out. So it's really the players who supply, who really flesh out the actual evidence of the oil shock. We present the idea, and they give us the actual boots-on-the-ground, grassroots reports of front lines of the oil shock.
So is this what people write about?
They write about all different things. Some people are looking at things kind of very strategically. They write about what's going on in a world without oil from kind of the geopolitical level. But most people are writing just about their lives and how their lives would be different. And they write about their attempts to begin bicycling to work. And they're writing about their attempts to kind of curtail using the car, or have they parked the car entirely. They're writing about their attempts to look at alternate means to get around, and whether or not the home that they're living in is actually proving to be viable for them has been a big theme. People realizing that they're too far out of town, they need to actually move into town. All sorts of changes like that have come out at very personal levels through the game.
You've been obviously reading almost everything, if not everything, that's come in. What are the most memorable blogs that have come in?
Oh, it's really hard to say. My mind is kind of perhaps over full. I've really enjoyed a blog by a player named Warren Wood, who lives in L.A. He's kind of gone through a tough time. L.A., of course, you know, not really very well equipped to deal with a world without oil. His posts have been very thought-provoking and very real. Early on, he packed a walkout pack, which he kept at his house, just basically preparing for that day when he might have to abandon his suburban existence and go someplace else. And so it was kind of a wrenching moment when, as a matter of fact, that day arrived. And he did finally use his walkout pack.
instituted a strict neighborhood guard. We live on the outskirts of town, so it's easy for us to see who's coming and going. 24 hours a day, we have people stationed at the entrances to the neighborhood. If you don't have a reason to be here, you don't get in. Yeah, sounds harsh, doesn't it? We learned quick after some jerks tried to siphon gas, and it took the cops an hour to get here. The criminals got away, and we realized that we would have to look after ourselves. Welcome to the Wild West, circa 2007.
So I'm here in Delft in the Netherlands, where I'm stranded because American Airlines has gone out of business.
Last Friday, June 29th, was one of Milwaukee's critical mass rides. If you've never heard of that, it's a cycling event started about 13 years ago in San Francisco. Basically a take back the streets sort of thing. Except this time there was nothing to take the streets back from.
We're in the back of a van right now with two guys that have one goal tonight: to steal as many bikes as they possibly can. Bike theft in the Bay Area is at an all-time high.
The scariest times for us have been when we were driving and people would try to jump into the bed of the truck at stop signs. We need a ride. I'll take people when I can. What I worry about is someone trying to carjack the truck. Half a tank is worth about $84.
Excerpts from the blogs and video from the alternate reality game World Without Oil, created by Ken Eklund. If you'd like to dive into the World Without Oil online, you'll find a link at our website, ttbook.org. And drop us a note while you're there. We always love to hear from you. Coming up, novelist Jim Crace imagines love and life in the post-apocalyptic world. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. The world's great religions have always told a story about a beginning, a middle, and an end. But the end of times in Christianity, Judaism, and Islam tell very different tales. Martin Marty is one of America's leading theologians. He taught for years at the University of Chicago. Marty told Steve Paulson that the rapture, popularized recently in the Christian series Left Behind, is a fairly recent concept.
You won't find that word in 18 centuries of Christian language. It's not in the Bible. It just isn't there. The best we can trace it is, using my thesis that fundamentalisms are very modern, a woman named Margaret MacDonald in a little cottage in Glasgow, Scotland, has visions and reads about them and compares and gets out mathematics and figures out when the world will end and that it will be done through this rapture.
When was she?
1840s. Major figures, John Darby, not a well-known figure in America, but a major thinker of that, and John Irving, they don't credit her, but it's growing up in the same soil, developed this, including much more elaborate biblical studies. We got it because Dwight Moody, the top American evangelist for a half century, commuted over there and picked up things from Darby and Irving and brought it here and started proclaiming it at conferences, and the Moody Bible Institute came along. It was generating, and it's done at the time when there are big battles over creation, how the world got started, evolution, and progressivism, which they hated, because progressivism and optimism said, as the world goes on, science and reason will do better and better, and we'll create a good new world. And that contradicted their vision of a changing world that they weren't controlling anymore, and it contradicted the theme in the Bible that there will be hard times coming and then Jesus will rescue it.
So the basic scenario in the rapture is that there will be some sort of Armageddon where most people will be wiped off the earth, but Jesus will descend from the heavens.
Jesus will descend, and the rapture will take his saints up with him. There are three or four different versions of it, but it's that kind of plot. And there will be a battle of Armageddon, yes, and most people will be vanquished and the saints will live and Jesus will rule for 1,000 years. Again, you might get prefigurings of that among mystics and dreamers and wild people. But there was no church-wide program of this. This is the very time when fundamentalism is getting formed, and these forces all come together and becomes a major, major theme. Suddenly you have a way of explaining a world that you aren't running and don't like. Suddenly you have a way of saying, we are the pure group and they're the impure, etc. We can make sense of the newspapers and they can't. Jesus prophesied that there'll be wars and rumors of war and men's heart failing for fear. Look out the window, there's World War I and it's all happening. Curiously, William Jennings Bryan, the most notable layperson as a fundamentalist, had been a pacifist Secretary of State just before World War I. And then he saw all the upheaval, all the meaninglessness of all that. He's looking for another plot, and he becomes identified with them along the way. Kind of a loose cannon in it because he didn't agree with everything they did, but he was their champion. And there it lay again. Nobody paid a lot of attention to it for some time. And then the birth of Israel was a very big part of it.
A big part of it for Christians.
Yes. Yeah, much more than for Jews. The really Orthodox Jews don't believe that Israel is a fulfillment of prophecy. You have to wait for the Messiah to come. So that the people that Americans see as most Orthodox Jews, the Haredim, the people wearing the black beards and the black outfits and so on, they're not technically fundamentalists and they're not technically second coming people, though Messiah will come and then there would be an Israel. So it's mainly Christians, and that's a big power. Israel likes it that they are there. Some of the governments of Israel have really made use of them along the way. Well, now, how do we make the leap from belief in the end of the world and so on to connecting it to the birth of Israel? And that's an American story. It's not an Israeli story. There was Christian Zionism before there was Jewish Zionism. And when people say it was this fundamentalist movement about Israel being key to the coming of Christ invented in Jerusalem, I say, no, it was invented in Oak Park, Illinois. That is a very successful, devout business person. I think he was in insurance. William E. Blackstone came under the influence of some of these people, heard about a church, started teaching it, and it caught on. And pretty soon he had powerful people. President Harrison, Supreme Court justices, signed a memorial or petition that there should be a birth of Israel. Now, a lot of people, I don't think President Harrison had the faintest idea what's going on here, but it seemed like a nice thing because Americans are very friendly to Jews and Israel, and let it happen. But then at the time of World War I, they got a new round of it, and then after the war, Balfour Declaration and so on, the soil is ready, and there's a whole new round of this, and you reorganize, and you have a new memorial, and then comes the birth of Israel. Now, to the Islamic fundamentalists, this ruins the whole plot because somebody has taken Islam dumb. As far as Islam is concerned, militant Islam. This was our territory. Palestinians were Arab Muslims, and the West, Christians and Jews, came in and planted here. And that's why radical fundamentalists in that world, including presidents of some states, say, we have to wipe Israel off the map. We have to drive them into the sea.
Well, is there a comparable end-time scenario in Islam?
Islam has end-time scenario, yes. But I don't think they're as motivated by that in this form of Christianity. You're motivated by the fact that you have insider knowledge of when and how, not exactly when, but the signs are all there, and that you are to be its instruments and so on. In Islam, Allah is the instrument and it's leading you to some sort of future. Islam is much more interested in purging Islamdom of the outsider who came in, because all visions of the Islamic future have the world coming to the same view. We hear it very recently, some of the debates about how you have to get rid of the West, you have to get the Jews down, so that these, in Shiite Islam, the 12th Imam comes and it's all fulfilled.
But what you're saying, particularly regarding Christian attitudes about the state of Israel, is it helps to explain why the volatility in Israel is so loaded. I mean, once you inject these end-time scenarios, and on top of the political unrest as well, I mean, there's a real pot that's brewing there, a volatile pot.
Oh, yes. It's a very scary kind of thing. Now, most Jews in Israel don't believe this scenario. There are a few in little messianic movements, Jews for Jesus in America, types like that. The vast majority of Jews in Israel are secular. I would speak at Hillel Foundation at Jerusalem, and if I would ask how many of you think that the God of Israel gave Israel exactly these boundaries, they'd say, who are you talking about? God of Israel was not big to them. The land was very important. At noon hour, they're out digging in the caves. They love Israel. If they're at all religious, they like that. But they don't think it's Christians that say these are the boundaries that have to be. And then along comes some Jewish fundamentalisms. Gush Emunim is particular, small movement, but they were coalescent with them. But then you have leadership that says, where does the money come from? One American group has raised hundreds of millions of dollars among our fundamentalists to support Israel.
Who do they give the money to?
Well, the government and agencies and so on. And it works through politics. Tom DeLay, a member of this outlook, said, since the Bible has told us this is how it has to be, and there must be an Israel for Jesus to come again, we will back Ariel Sharon no matter what he wants, because he is God's current custodian of that promise. Now, Sharon less so. Begin played right into it. He would give awards to American fundamentalists and vice versa. And when you confront them, they'll always say, well, don't we all have to make strange compromises? So we have to hold our nose. Here's a group that believes that when Jesus comes again, we'll all either be killed or converted. And that's not our scenario.
But right, because, not, I mean, it doesn't really match up because, I mean, the Christians don't really want God to come and save all the Jews, I would presume.
They're not part of Act 3. They're part of Act 1. And I think the Jews who accept this know that, but they will say, look, we're talking survival, and if this is how it has to come, we'll do it. And so they've developed friendly relations very often. And you have movements in America that, well, one of the prophecies says there has to be a sacrifice of a red heifer on the mount of the temple. So there's some people in Texas that are breeding until they can get a red heifer, so they have that ready. There's just all kinds of scenarios like this, which is not what Israel believes, but here's where the support comes from and the money comes from.
This is really pretty scary, isn't it? I mean, once you throw nuclear weapons into the equation and some leaders in the Middle East who, don't always seem to be the most reliable in the world. We really need to take this seriously, don't we?
Yeah, I find it very scary. What I try to do in my own work, first of all, I tend to be a kind of a moderate scholar, and I'm not an agitator, so I'm not saying get out in the streets and fight this. But as a teacher, I try to frame it in such a way that we do our own thinking about what this can mean. Because when you tie the politics, the land, and religion, you get a very volatile kind of mix. And in an era now when we have so many firebrands on all sides, you could get any kind of nut. I mean, some of the biggest setbacks we've had in Israel have come through a murder of a rabbin or a murder in the Al-Aqsa Mosque or something like that. You can see how close we come at such times. It's very hard to cool people off. If the Pope can say something that offends them and people even get killed, you could see what it'd be when you get to that sacred center of things. So yes, it's extremely volatile, and I think it makes it harder to deal with the reality of the survival and defense of Israel, because this means that all the enemies of Israel will identify every positive move as part of what the great Satan is doing.
Martin Marty is one of the country's leading theologians. Marty taught for decades at the University of Chicago Divinity School. Jim Crace says fiction has a job to do. It must help us imagine the unimaginable. Crace is an award-winning novelist whose work tends to look at the shadow side of life. His newest book is called The Pest House and examines a post-apocalyptic America after an unnamed eco-disaster has brought about social and economic collapse. Crace's two main characters, Franklin and Margaret, try to make their way to Fairytown in the hope of finding a better life across the Atlantic in Europe. Here's Crace reading from The Pest House.
Unlike the tree-trunk barns and cabins in the valley, the hillside hut had not been built for comfort. It was, at core, a woodsman's soddy, constructed out of sun-dried turfs, fireproof and wind-protected, much loved by mice, but easily collapsed. Indeed, it had collapsed from time to time, in those far-regretted days when it had had little use. But since that healthy time, that time of remedies and cures, the pest house had been strengthened by an outer wall of boulders, dry-built and sturdy. There was a sleeping bench inside, a hearth, a chimney stack, a leather bucket, and some pots.
Jim Crace describing the pest house that gives his new novel its name.
At all times in history, we've had a sense that the world is unblemished and will remain unblemished forever, that it's untouchable, that it's here for eternity. But at the same time, we are fearful of the oddities in the way that people in the medieval times would be terrified by an eclipse of the sun, because we rely on things that we don't understand. And when something we don't understand, such as the sun, disappears for 24 hours or whatever it is, for an hour or so during a total eclipse, then that can be terrifying. We, of course, understand the nature of the universe much more, not entirely, but much more now. But there are still new things to frighten us. What is certain is that in the 21st century, we are besieged by different versions of how the world could end or change drastically and how that could happen soon. You know, we're told about things like nuclear meltdown. We're quite used to that over the last 70 years. But there are new things that we've added to that. Global warming. Finally, America and Europe, but America particularly, has recognized that global warming is galloping us towards problems. And there are other things such as contagions and pandemics. Now, I know that in the medieval times, people took those in their stride. They expected there to be black deaths and choleras. Modern medicine has rescued us from those things largely. But look at the way in which AIDS now affects 40% of the people in Botswana and Lesotho. And then compare that with what happened in the United Kingdom, the hospital factory of the United Kingdom, where every ill is supposed to be curable. Over Christmas, we had avian flu, was thought to affect our turkey population. And I heard a scientist saying that if avian flu is able to cross species, and the number of deaths is equal to the number of deaths, you know, the same proportion as the number of the deaths that happened in 1919, the last time avian flu affected the United Kingdom, then 19 million people in the United Kingdom could die.
Let's talk about your story, then, this story, yeah. This future that you've created. I don't think it's giving anything away to say that this is America at some unspecified future date, clearly far enough in advance that the disaster occurred well before the beginning of the story. No one really remembers it, although close enough to that, I gather, that the artifacts can still be found regularly of the time before the disaster, whatever it was.
Well, how long does it take anything to rot away? How long does it take a hulk of a ship to be reduced to something which looks almost natural? Probably 80 or 90 years. I mean, we know that polystyrene cups are going to still be there untouched in 1,000 years. But yes, you're quite right. I would say probably 100 years after now is what we're talking about.
And the people who have survived this now live with very little memory of that time. There seems to be almost no history for them.
Well, if you imagine a huge depopulation of America for one reason or another, we don't know what it's going to be, whether it's a pandemic or whatever it is. If you imagine a huge depopulation and a sudden one, even if that depopulation is worldwide, the effects on developed nations such as America and Britain is going to be greater than the effects on somewhere like the Sudan or a remote island in Indonesia. The reason is that our advanced civilizations are so separated from the natural world that we wouldn't know how to find and forage. We wouldn't know how to make rafts. Our ingenuity has failed to keep us informed about how to make fire or shelters, you know, with the help of a building company or safety matches. And so it would not be surprising if there was a collapse of population in the United States of America, given the size of the United States of America, if the infrastructure just collapsed. So that's the starting point. But what this book is not trying to do is to say this isn't a likely outcome for America. That's not the point about this book. This is not a book about America 200 years down the line or 100 years down the line saying this is a likely scenario. All this is a metaphor. It's a metaphor for what I'm concerned about the American condition now. It's about our Western unconcern for the planet. It's about the dangers of being on the top of the pile and coping with being at the bottom of the pile. It's about the American dream and whether the American dream has become blemished in the same way as the American landscape has become blemished.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the dream. I mean, I think we all know what the American dream is supposed to be now. You're you better yourself. In some ways, the dream of your characters is the same, and perhaps what you're saying is that their dream is not much different from ours. It's to attain something that they don't understand at all.
The American dream, it seems to me, is based on something very simple, and it's what accounts for the fact that even though when they carried out an opinion poll in the Middle East just after the beginning of the Iraq War, they asked the question, which country in the world do you most despise? And 84%, I think, said America, predictably, you know, in the circumstances. But later down the opinion poll, they said, which country in the world would you most like to emigrate to? And 83%, you know, only lost 1% of those, said the United States of America. Now, this, in an odd way, it tells us about the whole ambiguity of the world's relationship with America. We love America in America, but we feel uneasy about America outside of America because we feel the world is becoming homogenized, not just homogenized by CNN and the CIA and American uniforms, but homogenized by makes of coffee and hamburger and films. Why is it that America, even though the people who despise America politically, their foreign policy anyway, why is it that they still want to come here? It's because the American narrative is one of delivering on hopes, on coming up with the acre of land when you've never owned land, on giving the job when the dust bowls have robbed you of them, of giving you the Hollywood dream if you meet the West Coast. It's a dreaming narrative. American is based on a dreaming narrative, it seems to me. And that dreaming narrative is one which I, as an Englishman, have always bought into. Because the English narrative is entirely different. The English narrative is squeamish and stuttering and blushing. And it doesn't take any risks and it doesn't head out for the frontier. And even if it did head out for the frontier, there'd be no wilderness to encounter. So there's something very basic about the appeal of that press westward, the family with the kids on the mother's breast and the bucket and the cow tied to the back of the wagon, which in a way is beyond destruction. However, it feels that we've lost an image of that. We've lost that because when people now think about America, they don't think of those things. They think of something which is blemished. So my book is about investigating the blemish and revisiting the dream.
We should talk about where your book begins. It is in this future America, and the characters about whom we will care the most are Franklin and Margaret, going not west, as you suggest, but east, in the hope that they will reach the sea and be taken to some promised land. Maybe we ought to know a little bit more about Franklin and Margaret. And if you would, I wonder if you would read a little bit to describe Franklin for me.
In what remained of the slanting light, Franklin Lopez tried to sleep while facing east, downhill. The closeness of Ferrytown was a comfort to him. From his high vantage point, he had seen the busy little lanes and yards and watched the ferry, its raft boards packed with the day's last emigrants and their suddenly weightless possessions, as it was let out on its fat ropes to drift downstream, never quite capsizing, until the four helmsmen dug in their great oars and poles to bring the craft ashore in the shallows of the deeply gravelled landing beach. He had then watched the ferry, unladen, but now set against the river, being towed back upstream by a team of oxen on a winch, and beached for the night at the mooring. He had seen the first lamps lit and heard what sounded like a song. Surely Franklin could not wish for a prospect more reassuring or more promising than this. Once the moon came up, above the leaden volumes of clouds augmenting what was left of day, the lake in the valley, hidden up till then in mist, was like a silver pendant, with the river as its glinting chain. Franklin had not seen so much standing water before. Perhaps the sea would be like that, flat and safe and breathtaking.
It's disturbing, don't you think, that Franklin takes so much comfort in being close to Ferrytown, this place that we know by this time is going to be a place of death? Or is that just another part of this exploration you're making of the way in which our dreams aren't necessarily what we think they are?
Well, we take human comfort in things, but nature
doesn't always play along. You know, it's a natural disaster that kills off the people in Ferrytown. That natural disaster is not something that I invented. Somebody reproved me in the English press for coming up with something which was simply unbelievable. But toxic gaseous escapes from lakes do happen. In fact, in the 1980s, in Lake Nyos in the Cameroons, there was exactly that same kind of flatulence which killed 3,000 people in their beds overnight. So these things do happen. In my books, there's always a tension that exists between the natural world and the so-called civilized world. And my books are always trying to mediate them. If you're going to mediate the natural world and the human world, then it's wrong to pretend that the natural world only comprises of daffodils and kingfishers and rainbows. The natural world can be sour. The natural world can be full of putrefaction. The natural world can be unnecessarily shocking and cruel. So if we're going to get any mediation between those two things, we might as well admit the truth about it. In the same way that we, humankind, can be lacking in understanding of the natural world and inflict damage on the natural world in the careless way that we have, then the natural world can do the same back to us.
And this pest house, it's more attractive than it ought to be. In some ways, it turns out the pest house is the rock on which the rest of the story is built.
The pest house is America. The pest house is where you go to recover. There are such things. This book started, actually, with me discovering a real pest house on the Isles of Scilly, 35 miles off the coast of Cornwall, where I spend a lot of time, 140 islands there, of which only five are inhabited. And there's one uninhabited one, which in the 18th century was used as a quarantine station for people traveling to the United Kingdom. If you had so much as acne or rosacea or something, people would suspect it would be cholera, and they'd stick you in this pest house until you recovered. Of course, you wouldn't recover because there's already someone there that had got cholera, so you'd catch it and you'd die. And when I saw that, I thought, well, what a fantastic title for a book. But I also realized that there was an important subject matter there, and the subject matter was emigration and our need to leave home to realize our hopes by going abroad to find those hopes. But hopes dashed, because here would be people traveling on a boat, and simply because they had a red cheek, even though they were within 35 miles and in sight of the cliffs of Cornwall, they would be stuck into the pest house and they would die. So that was the starting point of the book. At that point, when I encountered that story and that actual building, the subject matter of America was not one that I thought would fit into it. It was only when I became conflicted in my own attitudes towards America, you know, after 9/11 and after the Iraq War and after many, many visits here, that I realized that they were all of a piece.
And the pest house must hold some hope for you as well. In this story, it certainly does. Margaret survives the pest house, builds a future on having been in the pest house.
The hope is this, that optimism and hope are found in dark places. An optimism which is found, you know, in a well-lit Hollywood studio is not an optimism worth having. An optimism which is found in a religion which tells you that when you die, you know, you're merely going to spend eternity with heaven. It's such an infantile optimism that it's worthless. I'm an immensely optimistic person. And the optimism that I find in my books, although most people don't recognize it as optimism, is optimism which is as hard as granite because it's come from a tough place. So what I'm saying, I think, in this book is that we all have to go through the pest house, or what that represents, the metaphor of the pest house. America as a nation has to go through the pest house. Britain has and will continue to have to go through pest houses in order to experience the furnace that life provides and in order to come out stronger. That's what my optimism is about. My optimism is about the fact that the world is full of sour noises, but it's those sour noises that provides the actual harmony in the end.
Jim Crace is an award-winning novelist. His latest is called The Pest House. Coming up, a cosmologist forecasts the death of the sun and the end of the planet Earth. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. With so much to worry about on terra firma, it's easy to forget the big picture. But as with all of its living and breathing inhabitants on planet Earth, the universe will come to an end one day. Lawrence Krauss is an astrophysicist at Case Western Reserve University. He told Steve Paulson that our expanding universe is just the beginning of the end.
It looks like it will go on expanding forever. Not just expanding, but in fact expanding at a faster and faster rate, which is really surprising. It is actually totally inexplicable at the present time. We really don't know exactly what it is that's causing that repulsive force. We have some ideas. But it also means, if it's true, the future of the universe is dramatically different than we thought it would be before. And from the point of view of the future of life, unfortunately, it appears to be the worst of all possible universes to live in.
Now, why would that be? What does it matter whether the galaxies are rapidly moving apart?
To most people, it may not seem to matter what the galaxies are doing to their everyday life. And in fact, that's true. What happens to our galaxy is on a timescale that's really irrelevant for our everyday life. But if you're interested in thinking of the long-term future of life, as we learn more about the universe, we want to study the universe and learn more and more about it. And the old wisdom was that the longer we waited, the more of the universe we would see. Because after all, light travels at a finite rate. Therefore, if the universe is, say, 12 billion years old, we can only see out a certain distance because light has only had 12 billion years to travel to us, even if the universe is, say, infinite in size. If we waited longer and longer, we would see more and more of it. But in fact, in such a universe where things are accelerating, we see less and less of the universe with time because objects eventually speed up so that relative to us, they're actually traveling away at faster than the speed of light. Now, that may sound impossible, but it's not. In fact, the rules of general relativity tell us that things that are far away from us can travel with respect to us faster than the speed of light. The implication is once they are doing so, they become invisible to us.
But aren't you talking about billions of years from now?
Of course I am.
It's worth noting that the Earth is only, 5 billion years old?
We're talking about 18 or 20 billion years. That's like that joke about someone who was told the sun was going to die in a few million years. He said, a few million years? Oh, no. And the person said, oh, no, it's really a few billion years. And the fellow goes, oh, good. I was worried. The point is that, yes, this is a cosmic time frame. This is not going to be relevant to us and our nearby civilization. But in fact, there's actually even a worse implication of all of this, but it takes place on a much longer time scale. We have argued that if the universe is accelerating, that in fact life ultimately has to end.
Hmm.
You know, again, that may seem esoteric, and it absolutely is. But it amazes me that we can use some very basic laws of physics. Here we are sitting on a planet around a star in a remote corner of a remote galaxy in the middle of nowhere, and yet we may be able to argue about the ultimate future of life in the universe on the basis of very simple physical laws.
Why would life end because the universe is accelerating?
Well, the point is that life requires energy. We're learning that now as more and more in our society. We depend on imported fuel and eventually maybe solar power. But life requires energy to survive. And in a universe where things are moving away from us ever faster, we really have access to only a finite amount of the universe to try and get energy from. Right now we get it from our sun, later on maybe from other sources. But we know that if the universe is accelerating away from us, then basically, even in an infinite amount of time, we only have access to a finite amount of energy.
Now, I want to bring this discussion down to Earth. At least,
if it's possible.
Yeah, at least talking about the future of Earth itself. Now, you said that life will end if this theoretical model holds up many billions and billions of years from now. What about the Earth itself or our solar system?
Okay, well, the future of our Earth is dismal. The first kind of disaster that might befall us, if we think about the disasters of the future, is the fact that the sun is actually getting brighter with time. It was about 20% less bright than it is now when life first evolved on Earth. And we know in about 2 billion years, it will become about 15 to 20% brighter. Now, when that happens, what will happen is there'll be a runaway greenhouse effect, just like happened on Venus, we believe, several billion years ago. Venus is the way it is because it's just a little bit closer to the sun than we are. And what happens is the sun heats up the water evaporates. Water vapor is a greenhouse gas, and it causes the system to get hotter, and then more water evaporates, and you get a runaway effect, and all the water on Venus evaporated and eventually left the atmosphere, and it became so hot that the surface temperature of Venus is greater than about 1,000 degrees. When the sun reaches about 15% greater luminosity than it has now, greater brightness than it has now, the Earth will be in the zone in which there'll be a runaway greenhouse effect, just like Venus. Hmm. Now, maybe there'll be some technological fix for that. Maybe we can put a big umbrella over the atmosphere. Or, in fact, I have great confidence that we might be able to do something like that. So maybe we can save ourselves at least 2 billion years in the future. But then 5 billion years in the future, the sun will burn up its hydrogen fuel. Then you might think it would go out like a candle burns out in the dark, but in fact, it will do exactly the opposite. The inside of the sun will start to shrink, and it'll get hotter, and the outside of the sun will puff up, and eventually the sun will become what's called a red giant, and the size of the sun will be such that it will actually encompass the Earth's orbit. Now, the Earth will, during the process, actually get pushed out a little bit, but it's hard to imagine at that point much you can do to save the Earth.
So at that point, we better have those spaceships ready so we can start voyaging into other areas.
Exactly. In fact, at that point, one hopes if we have a civilization that survives that long, since we know it's coming, we'll be able to have spaceships ready, or maybe we'll be able to colonize Mars, for example, as the simplest alternative. There's lots of alternatives. The end of the sun and the end of the Earth do not have to mean the end of life.
But if the sun disappears, then there's no point in colonizing Mars, is there?
But the sun will be bright for a while longer in its new form, and Mars will be farther away, and we could live on there for a while. But you're right, when the sun stops providing power, then there's no point in staying on Mars, and the real point is to build a roving, self-contained spaceship that either supplies its own power by taking in starlight or by using the magnetic fields of the galaxy, or where we eventually just move on and colonize some other world. I mean, all of this is science fiction, but I think the ultimate future of life, if it is going to have a future, is to imagine becoming wandering travelers. And in fact, you know, that's the history of life on Earth. If you think about it, in the past, groups have left where they were, where they, you know, were apparently comfortable, to go out on difficult and long voyages with the potential never to return. It's happened throughout human history, and people have done it when wherever they were became unbearable, either for political or religious reasons or economic reasons or something else. And eventually, our future is in the stars. We came from the stars. Every atom in our bodies was once inside the stars. We'd just eventually head back out there.
Lawrence Krauss is an astrophysicist at Case Western Reserve University. Steve Paulson spoke with him. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This program was produced by Veronica Rickard, with help from Mary Lou Finnegan, Charles Monroe Kane, Anne Strainchamps, and Doug Gordon. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. Kirill Owen is our technical director. You can buy a copy of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for The End of the World as We Know It, number 617B. If you have questions or comments about the program, you can send us email at ttbook.org. We always love to hear from you.
PRI, Public Radio International.